we saw why rationality is the foremost virtue of a code of ethics which holds man's life as its standard. Why, since man's basic tool of survival is his mind, is his reason, since his life and well-being depend upon perceiving and identifying the facts of reality correctly and of acting accordingly, thinking is the basic virtue that man can practice, the virtue at the root of any other virtue. And conversely, his cardinal and basic vice is evasion, blanking out, the willful suspension of consciousness, the refusal to see or to judge or to know. Now then, this evening I shall proceed to a discussion of some of the other virtues, the other basic principles of action required by a morality of life. I shall be concerned to elaborate the meaning of these principles of action and to show how they relate to the matter of survival. And the first of the virtues I shall discuss in this connection is the virtue of independence. Let me begin by quoting a brief paragraph from Galt's speech. Quote, "Independence is the recognition of the fact that yours is the responsibility of judgment and nothing can help you escape it. That no substitute can do your thinking as no pinch hitter can live your life. That the vilest form of self-abasement and self-destruction is the subordination of your mind to the mind of another, the acceptance of an authority over your brain, the acceptance of his assertions as facts, his say-so as truth, his edicts as middleman between your consciousness and your existence." Close quote. Strictly speaking, if one understands why rationality is man's cardinal virtue, it is something of a redundancy to add that man should be independent. That is, it is a redundancy to state that man should reason independently, since to reason dependently would be a contradiction in terms. Either man reasons or he doesn't reason. Either he is concerned with the correct cognition of reality or he is not. Either he seeks authentically to know and to understand, or he does not. In a word, either he thinks or he does not. A default on the virtue of independence can only be a default on the act of thinking and judging. The independent man is the man who assumes the responsibility of judging, of passing judgment on what is true or false, right or wrong. Feelings, wishes, hopes, evasions are not substitutes for judgment. When they are treated as tools of cognition, then they represent the attempt to escape rational judgment. There are no independent feelings or independent evasions. To substitute an emotion or an evasion for a thought is to renounce one's independence. It's important to stress this in every possible way, because some people have the totally fallacious notion that independence means acting on your, quote, own feelings, close quote. It means nothing of the kind. The man who blanks out, who doesn't exercise rational judgment, and who is run by his feelings, has to, a good deal of the time, function as a parasite on the thinking of others because no person is so blind as to literally believe that he can deal in reality guided only by his feelings. So that if he doesn't choose to accept the responsibility of thinking, a good deal of the time he is riding on the thinking or on the mistakes of others. He is an intellectual dependent. The intellectual dependent is the man who asks not what is true, but rather what do others think is true? What do others say is true? And making his mind subservient to the minds of others, accepts their pronouncements, their assertions, their say-so on faith. That is, without an act of independent critical judgment. If a man accepts an idea which he did not originate, because he has understood it, and by his own rational judgment is convinced that it is true, this does not make him a dependent. This does not make him a parasite. The fact that you learn from other men and are not the originator of every idea you hold does certainly not make you a dependent. One of the attributes that distinguishes man from the animals is precisely his power to transmit knowledge, so that the intellectual achievements of the past do not die with the men of the past. Necessarily, we all gain a great part of our intellectual possessions, so to speak, from other men. But there is a very real sense in which each man, if he is to be independent, must face existence as if he were alone, as if he were the first and only man on earth. Whether a new idea is the product of his own mind or of the mind of another man, he must consider that idea as if no mind had ever considered it before, as if no one had ever said it's true or it's false, as if he is alone to grasp it, to judge it, and to decide its truth or falsehood, validity or invalidity. The ideas of others can properly be used only as the material for one's thought, as that about which one thinks, among other things. But the evaluations of other men must not be a substitute for one's own evaluation, for one's own judgment. The independent man accepts as true those ideas and only those ideas which he has understood, which his own mind has grasped and judged as true. He accepts only that which makes first-hand sense to him. Now here again, a certain aside is necessary. I say that an independent man accepts only that which makes sense to him. This doesn't mean that if you hear an argument, which in fact is irrefutable, you are spared the necessity of ever committing yourself one way or the other by simply saying, well, this doesn't make sense to me. I'm not convinced. You haven't persuaded me. If a person gives you an argument, and if you're not persuaded, or if it's something you don't understand, you have to know what and why. You may want time to think it over if you can't immediately say why you don't agree with it. But you cannot permit yourself forever to evade the responsibility of passing judgments by simply saying, well, I don't know, I'm not convinced, period. Before a man accepts any idea, he must identify and grasp those facts and concepts from which the idea is derived. That is, he should be able to prove the idea. To do less is to take the idea on faith. The dependent man absorbs and retains only the conclusions of another's thinking, not the reasons which validate those conclusions. The mark of the independent man is that he grasps not merely conclusions, but conclusions and their proofs as well. If a man simply memorizes conclusions which he doesn't authentically understand, he will not know how to use those ideas productively or creatively. He may be able to repeat them by rote, he may be able to sling formulae, he will not know how to think with the ideas if he doesn't understand the concepts that validate them, the facts of reality from which they were derived. And in this connection, I am reminded of a man I knew some years ago who was studying objectivism. This was before the founding of NBI. And I noticed that while he was a quite intelligent person, he showed remarkably little ability, puzzlingly little ability, at the art of thinking creatively or productively with objectivist ideas. And in the course of a conversation one day, I learned that he, in effect, was functioning on the following kind of fallacy. Once upon a time, either Ayn Rand or Nathaniel Brandon had discussed various aspects of the philosophy with him. He had asked them questions. He had heard their arguments and their reasoning. And at the time, he was satisfied that their reasoning was valid and made sense. Having satisfied himself that the reasoning was valid, he decided that it was now necessary only that he retain the conclusions of the discussion, secure in the knowledge that the proof was, after all, safely in reality, locked up, so to speak, or deposited inside the vault of Miss Rand's and Mr. Brandon's head, like a filing cabinet where you keep records that you don't want to clutter up your desk with. Well, you cannot treat ideas that way and expect them to do you much good. You cannot delegate to somebody else the job of knowing the proofs of your convictions. You see, the more obvious kind of mistake is the person who simply accepts something on faith from the beginning because it feels right or it emotionally appeals to him. But the subtler form of error is the person who exercises judgment when he is first hearing the case. He doesn't accept it on faith originally, but once he's satisfied that the arguments make sense, he then proceeds to forget them. He knows they're there. He can always get them out of his files. That is, pick up a telephone and ask Rand or Brandon. He knows the answers exist. He's seen them. So now all he needs is the conclusion. But that's not true. If you want to think productively with ideas, you have to know their proofs, you have to know how one concept relates to another, how they are derived, how they are structurally organized. Otherwise, it isn't knowledge that you possess. A man is safer when he makes an error through his own judgment than when he blindly and uncritically accepts the correct judgment of others. If he does judge, does think, but makes an honest mistake, then he may have to pay the consequences of his error in action, but he still has retained the means, the method, of correcting his error and arriving at truth. But the dependent is not only unable to apply his memorized formulae successfully in any situation which is the least bit subtle, he is pursuing a course that renders him unable to distinguish truth from falsehood. A common fallacy concerning the actual nature of independence is often expressed in some such statement as this: no one can be fully independent because we all have to rely on experts in fields of knowledge outside our own. If you are sick and the doctor tells you that you need an operation, don't you have to take his word for it? Let's consider the confusion and the fallacy involved here. A man, to begin with, does not have to be omniscient or a universal scholar in order to know what he is doing. He needs only to know very clearly what are his grounds for any given decision, and that they are sufficient and rational. We all must, at times, make decisions without full knowledge, act without full certainty. We must all take the calculated risk of trusting the competence of a specialist in some field of endeavor. But a calculated risk is rationally justified only if it is a calculated risk and not a blind leap in the dark. It is not, for example, it is not a rationally calculated risk to walk into the office of the first doctor whose shingle one happens to see, knowing nothing about the man's qualifications or past record, and then agree to have him take out the appendix one could have sworn was removed years ago. Rationality and independence require, when one is dealing with an expert, that one have a first-hand reason for confidence in the competence of that expert. It requires further that one never cease to judge what the expert is saying and doing. If, for instance, your doctor prescribes a medicine that makes you progressively more and more ill, you do not continue to go to him on the grounds that, since he is an expert, he must know what he is doing, despite the fact that you were healthier before he began treating you. You don't, or shouldn't, suspend judgment merely because you go to someone seeking services in a field where presumably he knows more than you do. I can think of a personal example where several years ago I was having some trouble with my eyes, and I went to a very highly recommended ophthalmologist, and he gave an explanation of what the problem was. Only I tried to follow his advice, and something about it didn't make sense. I didn't have a great deal of confidence in him, in spite of the recommendations I had heard, and I went to a different ophthalmologist just to check up, and got quite a different interpretation of what the problem was, which proved to be correct because the problem was resolved immediately. Another example familiar to many of us who drive cars is the following. Suppose that something is wrong with the car, and you're not a mechanic. I don't think anybody on earth knows less about automobiles than I do. Not very many people, anyway. Peculiar noises come from the car, and you have to take it in for a checkup. Well, now, if you go to a garage station, every time you wander in there, you're informed that something incredible is wrong. You get suspicious, don't you? And you think, perhaps this garage operator is being less than altogether candid in his diagnosis. So you shop around until you find the station who, by their general manner of dealing with you, gives you the impression that they are reliable and don't invent imaginary troubles. But even then, and this is a very important point, Even if I decide to take the mechanic's word for it, which I may do, deciding I have reason to do so, that doesn't mean that I know he is right. If, for example, there is some weird or unpleasant noise or unpleasant odor coming from my car, and he tells me that it's such and such, and I say, fine, go fix it up, and I come back the next day to get the car, and the trouble is gone, that doesn't mean I know for a fact that the trouble was what he said it was. Conceivably, he could have erred too, or didn't tell me the truth. The point is that there are times when we have to act knowing that we don't know for sure, but knowing that there are grounds to warrant us taking the action anyway. And such decisions are forced upon us all of the time. We don't always act with full knowledge. A great deal of the time we act with far less than full knowledge. But we do have to know what we know. We have to know why we are doing what we are doing. And if we are taking a calculated risk, we have to know why we consider it justifiable to do so. But you cannot accept an idea as true. You cannot accept it as your knowledge unless you know why it is true. Thus, you may be willing to accept the statements of a doctor as probably true if you have first-hand knowledge of his reliability. You may be willing, justifiably willing, to act on his advice. But if you do not know medicine, you do not literally know that his statements are true. You must always, therefore, distinguish between that which you actually know and that which you have reason, good reason perhaps, to assume is true and are willing to act on, but which you do not literally and actually know to be true. There is one field in which every one of you must, in a crucial sense, be an expert, and that is the field of philosophy. I do not mean by this that each of you must be a professional academic philosopher. I do not mean that you have to involve yourself with the more technical aspects of philosophy, if that's not your interest. I mean that on the broader, more fundamental level, everyone does have a philosophy of life, and he should know firsthand why he believes what he believes. He must have reasons for his convictions. He should know the basis of his own premises. He cannot act and live his life on the advice of a professional philosopher in the same sense that, in a limited sense, he can take the advice of a doctor. The reason for this is that philosophy, and particularly morality, involve and dominate every aspect of human existence. It isn't a specialty like medicine. Moreover, the facts with which a philosopher deals are equally available to everyone. They're not the specialized kind of facts that a scientist deals with. An individual can learn from a professional philosopher, but he cannot say, as he might say about a doctor, since the philosopher appears competent, I'll take his word for it. I'll live according to his principles. I don't have time to think about those questions on my own. You cannot leave to anyone else the job of running your life. You have to know the reasons for the ideas by which you live. Now, the primary meaning of independence as a virtue is a psycho-epistemological meaning, as you can see. It pertains to the action and function of your consciousness. It pertains to how your consciousness functions, to the issue of whether or not you seek to know for yourself or blindly follow the authority of others, whether you judge or unthinkingly agree, submit, and obey. It's a psycho-epistemological issue. But there are certain related senses in which it is relevant to talk about the virtue of independence, which have relevance in an ethical discussion. You will sometimes see an extremely irrational statement to the following effect. It's nonsense to talk about independence. No one is independent. Everyone depends on everyone else. Aren't you dependent on the grocer from whom you buy your bread and meat? Well, here, of course, it is economic independence that is being discussed. The purpose of such an argument is to make you lose the concept of the difference between a relationship of trade among men who exchange value equivalents and the relationship of parasitism where one man gets an unearned support from another. If you pay the grocer for what you get, your relationship is one of independent equals. Independence does not require that you live on a self-sustaining farm. In the material or economic sphere, it merely requires that you produce the value equivalent of what you consume. Now there is one other aspect worth commenting on, and that is the issue of your moral independence of the actions of other men. No one's actions but your own can ever constitute a moral reflection on you. Very often, unfortunately, a person will, mistakenly, feel morally guilty for some irrationality or immorality committed by some other member of his family. But there can be no moral responsibility where there is no freedom of choice. And the only actions over which you have the power of choice are, of course, your own. You cannot be guilty because of anyone else's immoral actions unless you sanction those immoral actions. And then what you are guilty of is not the other person's actions, but your own action, that of sanctioning his actions. There is no way for a man to possess self-esteem, no way to hold the inner certainty of his competence to deal with reality if he does not practice the virtue of independence, if he does not assume the responsibility of independent judgment, for the very simple reason that a man cannot be convinced of the efficacy or the competence or the rightness of his mind and of its method of functioning if his characteristic method is to suspend his mind in blind obedience or agreement to the assertions of others. Now let us turn to another cardinal virtue of the objectivist ethics, that of integrity. If rationality and independence demand that you think, the virtue of integrity demands that you remain loyal to your thinking in action, which means it demands that you not betray the judgment of your own mind. To practice integrity means to be integrated, to allow no split between theory and practice. No split between one's convictions and one's actions. Now, according to the conventional altruist view of morality, integrity is a virtue because, as they see it, it requires the sacrifice of one's self-interest to one's moral principles. This view, of course, rests on a prior premise. The premise that one's moral convictions have nothing to do with one's self-interest, or with reality, or with reason, and that one's practical self-interest would lie in acting contrary to one's moral convictions. It rests on the premise that the good in theory is the destructive in practice, that man's mind and body are two warring elements, that his spirit requires that which would make his physical survival and well-being impossible. It assumes a split between the moral and the practical. But if reason, not faith, is the standard by which one forms one's concepts of good and evil, then there is no split between theory and practice, between the moral and the practical. The rational and the moral is that which serves man's self-interest and his survival and well-being on earth, serves it objectively and in fact. If one's convictions are rational, then integrity, meaning loyalty to one's judgment, to one's mind, to one's convictions, is a practical necessity of human survival. The meaning of integrity as applied to consciousness is confidence, the knowledge that the judgment of one's mind is valid. The meaning of integrity as applied to action is courage, the knowledge that to act on the judgment of one's mind is practical. If life on earth is the standard, then, to quote Galt, quote, courage and confidence are practical necessities. Courage is the practical form of being true to existence, of being true to truth, and confidence is the practical form of being true to one's own consciousness. Close quote. To remind you of a little story which Mrs. Brandon tells in her biographical study of Miss Rand in our book, Who is Ayn Rand? At the time when it was professionally dangerous to do so, Miss Rand, then working in Hollywood, was very outspoken in her public condemnation of communists in the movie industry. And there was a lot of pressure brought to bear, generally speaking, against people who spoke up in this manner on the part of the studios because they didn't want the bad publicity reflecting on Hollywood. When some of her conservative acquaintances complimented her on her courage, Miss Rand answered, "I'm not brave enough to be a coward. I see the consequences too clearly." To sacrifice one's convictions to the wishes of other men is an act of self-renunciation and self-destruction, and that's both impractical and immoral. If, for example, you know that individualism and capitalism are good because they make human survival possible, but you pretend to be sympathetic to or tolerant of collectivism because it is popular, you betray your own consciousness, you betray your own judgment, and support that which you know to be evil. You are not acting practically, you are paving the way for your own destruction, and you will have deserved it. If you are an atheist who pretends to believe in God, or perhaps to be only an agnostic because your relatives and friends are religious, if you betray your own judgment in order to cater to that which you know to be irrational, you will despise yourself, and you will deserve it. If in your work you hold high standards which you betray in order to gain the approval of men whose judgment you don't respect, you will destroy any pleasure your work could give you. You will undercut and invalidate the motive that had made you choose your work. You will perceive every compliment and every success as a reproach and a source of guilt. And you will be right to. Integrity requires of men, among other things, that they assume responsibility for the consequences of their own chosen actions. And this, of course, implies the previous responsibility that when they act, they should be concerned to know what will be the consequences of their actions.